Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Sally Kenny, author of Gender and Justice, Why Women in the Judiciary Really Matter, and Catherine Howe, whose new novel is The House of Velvet and Glass. Sally Kenny is the Newcomb College Endowed Chair, the Executive Director of the Newcomb College Institute, and a Professor of Political Science at Tulane University. She's the author of a newly published book, Gender and Justice, Why Women in the Judiciary Really Matter. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
How did you first get interested in women judges?
I heard a speech by Justice Rosalie Wall. And we had a women's leadership breakfast at the Women in Public Policy Center at the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota at 8 in the morning. And she came from quite a long ways and gave this really rousing speech to our students and some elected officials. And she told this story about how after she'd been nominated, a woman came up to her, grabbed her hand, and said, "Thank you for being ready." And when she told it, she teared up. And that really got my attention. And I was so impressed with her that I wanted to know more about how she came to be on the bench. And that's what really started the whole project.
And hers is a particularly great story, isn't it?
Well, she's one of these really great inspirational leaders that calls forth the best in everyone and pulls people together. And so she's just a really interesting figure, but also I became really interested about how emotional she was and my own emotional response to her. And that became one of the themes in talking and telling her story.
Now, the first couple of sentences in this book are a knockout. The first 101 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court were men. It took nearly 200 years for a president to appoint a woman. That's just stunning, isn't it?
It's even more stunning that we're going backwards and that people think we have equality when we don't. And it took so long to just get a toehold. And that's really what inspired me to write the book, is that I felt that there was a lot of complacency on this issue when our progress is really very fragile.
And there are a number of really familiar faces on the cover of this book. Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Tell us about studying their lives and work.
I became interested in O'Connor, of course. That was when I was really first starting in graduate school, and so we were interested in that. Justice Ginsburg, I really studied first through her opinion. So sex discrimination law was my field. She was the first head of the Women's Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. And my first book was on the exclusion of women from hazardous work, and she had really argued and litigated all of those cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. So I think I read every brief she had written. I read all the cases she argued, and my first graduate school paper was studying the ACLU Women's Rights Project litigation strategy.
Wow. I think we should say here that you read mystery novels for fun, shouldn't we?
For pleasure.
And this book is also international in scope.
I married a Brit. I went to university in England. I lived in England for 5 years. And I did my dissertation, and my first book was a comparative study of British and American sex discrimination law. So I was really interested in British sex discrimination law and studying it. And then, quite serendipitously, in the 1980s, the only way sex discrimination law was moving forward in Britain was because of the effect of the European Union on British law. And that led me to study the European Union's doctrine. And then I got really interested in the European Court of Justice itself as an institution.
And you did this as a kind of model of how to do feminist scholarship, didn't you?
I was so frustrated with my colleagues in political science who are a little bit too focused on quantitative analysis and using variables. And so when women started serving on the court, the first thing they wanted to know is whether women judges decided cases differently from men. Mostly they decided that they did not. But they kept asking the question over and over again as if it was the only thing they could think of to ask, and as if they were searching to find the true answer, and the only true answer could be yes, that no was not sufficient as an answer. And so I wanted to say there's so many other interesting political science questions one can discuss by studying women judges other than this one question, which has been studied to death.
Now, we're seeing an argument about women judges in Louisiana right now with our Supreme Court as Burnett Johnson fights to become the Chief Justice. What do you think about that?
I don't have a lot of inside information about that. It seems to me what I do know about the Louisiana Constitution is it turns on this question of who is the longest serving justice and what is the impact of the consent decree. And now I think it's also a question of who decides, which has been a question that's always been a part of our legal and political system from Bush versus Gore to the founding. So there's what is the right answer to the question, and then there's the question of who gets to decide what the right answer to the question is. I can say that one of the things that we found in my latest research is that women are much more likely to be chosen as chief if the Chief Justice is chosen by seniority or by the colleagues on the court themselves. And women are less likely to be Chief Justice, as in the case of Rose Byrd in California, if the governor chooses who is chief or if the voters decide who is chief.
How interesting. Mm-hmm. Oof. Now, your conclusion is that we need to mobilize to ensure a diverse judiciary. What does that sort of mobilization look like to you?
Well, we can take a lot of examples from the 1970s, and I have a chapter in the book on the Carter administration and how women's groups mobilize. One thing is to ask women to come forward and to put forth the names of qualified women, to count and to put pressure on decision makers that we can't go backwards, we have to go forward. But I also think that it's very likely that whatever got us from 0 to 5% and from 5% to 25% may not be exactly the same things that it's going to take to get from 25% to 50%. So I think we need to also be creative about what we need to do differently for success in our times. But we do have examples from how women in the suffrage movement mobilized to get Florence Allen on the Ohio Supreme Court in the 20s and then on the Sixth Circuit, and how we went from almost no women in the federal judiciary to 15% in the Carter administration. So I think we can take lessons from history, but we also need to be innovative and creative.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the interesting things about this book to me is that you're not saying women should be included because they're different. Tell us what you're really saying in this book.
I think women should not be discriminated against. I think one of the questions, I think the Attorney General in Florence Allen's appointment is, are you trying to get her appointed because she's a woman? And he said, no, I'm just trying to have her not be excluded because she's a woman. So I am somebody who approaches the issue from the standpoint of employment discrimination. And when we have a certain number in the qualified labor pool, and then we don't select proportionate to that number, we basically smell a rat. And we have had women increasing their percentages of the legal profession and coming to about 50% of law school graduates, but we haven't seen a proportionate increase in the number of women judges. And so I smell a rat. I think we need to take more care to make sure that the judicial selection system is not permeated with bias.
Mm-hmm. When you undertook this work, some people were concerned that this was a rather secretive world, that you might not be able to get the kind of information you wanted. How did you penetrate that secretive world?
In the UK, what happened, I was a candidate for an Atlantic Fellowship, And they didn't give me the fellowship the first year I applied, and they said, you cannot study this. It cannot be studied. And the next year, I reapplied, and luckily for me, the weekend before in the Sunday Times, the front page spread had been that they were alleging that the Lord Chancellor was selling judgeships to get money for the Labour Party. And so suddenly it became the most important political issue to study. And I got the fellowship. And really, the Lord Chancellor's office opened a lot of doors for me. So they called up judges and said, Professor Kenny is going to be sitting with you on the bench tomorrow. Welcome her to the court.
Oh, fun.
It was really great. It was really interesting. And so they were really reconsidering how they picked judges. So it was a very good time. And it wasn't so impossible to study after all. It's very hard for outsiders to find out how these secretive processes work, and that really works to insiders' advantage, and those insiders have been men. So how does one get one senator to nominate one for the court? How do you get chosen by judicial selection panels? These are the kinds of things that I think women should know about, too. I don't think you should have to be the college roommate of a congressman in order to serve in the federal judiciary. I think everybody who's qualified should be considered.
Oh, that's great. The fresh air of scholarship, as it were. We've been talking with Sally Kenny, whose new book is Gender and Justice, Why Women in the Judiciary Really Matter. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor.
I'm especially happy to talk to Catherine Howe today. I love her books. They're historical fiction that really draws the reader into her world. In The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, she takes us back to the witch trials of Salem. And in her most recent book, The House of Velvet and Glass, she writes about the sinking of the Titanic and the aftermath for the survivors who lost loved ones. It takes place in Boston and in the world of the supernatural. Catherine is speaking to us today from her home in Ithaca, New York, where she is a lecturer at Cornell University. Catherine, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here, Susan.
You draw on your own family history for this novel, don't you?
For The House of Velvet and Glass, I do in a funny little way. I was very interested by Boston in the 19-teens, and part of it is because in the course of doing a little bit of research to prepare for the novel, I was poking around in the Harvard University archives, and I came upon a cache of letters that had been sent home by a man who turns out to have been my great-uncle. And he sent these letters home to his father and to his wife. And he sends a letter, it's dated in 1917, and he's writing from a steamer that is crossing the Atlantic Ocean on its way from Boston to Europe. And I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have it in front of me, but he writes to his wife that she would love this passage, that they haven't sighted very many ships since they left New York, and that she would really love it because the ships go a little further south than when she went over since the Titanic hit the ice. And so he's saying that in 1917. It turns out that the reason that he hasn't spotted very many ships since they left New York is because he is not on a pleasure cruise. He's actually on his way over because he signed up with the Canadian Royal Fusiliers to fight in World War I. And I was really taken by the fact, first of all, that this man was in his late 30s. He was married. He had an established career. He was a pretty comfortably well-off Bostonian dermatologist. And I was baffled by the fact, first of all, that he would choose to sign up and go fight. And second of all, by the fact that he was traveling into a theater of war. And what was really on his mind when he wrote home to his wife was Titanic. And so I was really struck by the fact that this one huge disaster had social and cultural repercussions that we don't necessarily think about that much. And so the story in The House of Velvet and Glass is about a Boston family, the Alston family, and it follows the adventures of their eldest daughter, Sybil, after she loses her mother, Helen, and her sister, Eula, on Titanic, and what that does to Sybil's world and how it turns Sybil's world completely upside down.
Well, what's so fascinating to read is how that event haunted the survivors, and that's a whole class of society.
It is. It is. I mean, I think we think about Titanic, certainly when I picture Titanic, I don't know about you, but I picture the film. You know, I think about the sort of images that we all saw in the movie. And one thing that's really striking about Titanic is the way that it had these unexpected after effects. So one example is the library at Harvard University is named Widener Library. It's named after a man, a real guy, Harry Widener, who went down on Titanic. And Harry Widener shows up as a minor character in The House of Velvet and Glass. And the thing I love about Harry, there are a lot of things I love about him, but one of the things I really love about him is that he put on the manifest on Titanic, he had to list his occupation. And what Harry listed for his occupation is bibliophile. Because he was a professional book collector, which is to say he was a leisured gentleman. So Harry was lost on Titanic, and his mother, Eleanor, who survived, decided that the best way to memorialize him was to endow the library at Harvard. So even today, if you walk into Harvard University's main library, Harry Widener's study is preserved right in the center of it. It's basically like a mausoleum. And the Harvard University Library opened in 1915, which, by the way, was the same year Eleanor Widener remarried. It was very scandalous in the gossip press at the time. So I was interested by the fact that this loss, this momentous event, changed family structure, it changed culture, and it changed the way a lot of people lived at that time.
Oh, and I love the way the library is being built in the background of this book. That just thrilled me beyond belief. I can tell you love books the way I do.
I do love books. It's true. Well, one of my characters, Sybil's younger brother, Harley, is really struggling. He's a Harvard student when the action of the story takes place, which is in 1915. And at the beginning of the story, Harley's been kicked out of Harvard very abruptly, and we don't really know why. And before we can figure out what's going on with him, he disappears. And so much of the thrust of the story is trying to figure out what's happened to Harley and how he could be kind of redeemed. But we see Harvard through Harley's eyes a couple of times, and for him to go on campus and see this new library being built, it's just a huge reminder of the loss that his family has experienced. And I thought that that would be an interesting thing to explore from that time period.
Oh, I think it is. And also, as many people do who grieve, many turn to spiritualism for comfort. And this is at a time when scientists, Harvard scientists, were just beginning to investigate the paranormal.
It's true. And this is something that was fascinating to me when I was researching The House of Velvet and Glass. At the time, spiritualism and visiting spirit mediums and seances was a mainstream activity. Meeting times for seances would be published in the Boston newspaper at the same time as regular church services. So spiritualism had become popular starting in the mid-19th century, really peaked around the Civil War, and then peaked again in the 19-teens. And as you say, this is a time when, I don't know if you remember the opening scene of Ghostbusters with Bill Murray quizzing young undergraduates about whether or not they
yes.
have psychic abilities. Well, that was really going on in Harvard University in the 19-teens. William James himself was doing some of this psychical research, as they called it. And I was very intrigued by that kind of mainstream, different approach to the sense of the human soul, the substance of the human soul.
You seem to be interested in that moment that's on the cusp of modernism.
Well, I'm very interested by time periods in transition. So my first book, The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, revisits the Salem Witch Crisis, which is really just at the very beginning of the scientific revolution, when our understanding of science and reality and magic was very different.
And of course, we have to say that you are related to two of those accused witches.
It's true. Although most people who were accused as witches were accused not because they did anything wrong, but because they were cranky and quarrelsome people, which is, of course, nothing I would know anything about. But the 19-teens is a similarly transitional moment in time. In many respects, and this is true of southern cities like Houston and New Orleans, as it is true of Boston, these cities are starting to resemble their modern selves. We have automobiles in the streets. We even have electric cars in the streets. Waves of immigration have started to transform the nature of our cities. But at the same time, it's still very much a 19th century place. You still have people alive who were in the Civil War. You have people alive who had been enslaved. Women still can't vote. Influenza can still kill you. It's a very different and transitional time.
I love the way you talk about Marblehead as like this perfectly preserved 18th century town, you know, with a little bit of everything. You're really so accomplished at blending actual history with the supernatural. How do those beliefs touch your life?
Well, I have to say that for my part, I'm very interested in giving people credit for how they view the world. In the stories that I write, when dealing with questions of magic or questions of spiritual beliefs, I try to be very authentic to the way that those beliefs would have been experienced during that time period. So the starting point with Physic Book of Deliverance Dane was the question or the sort of challenge, what if one of the Salem witches were the real thing, but the real thing the way the colonists believed them to be, not in the pointy hat modern witch sense? And my question with the House of Velvet and Glass is, what does the world look like to you if you really think that you're able to communicate with your lost loved ones, if you have a technology available to you that you can communicate with your lost loved ones? How does that change the way you value your life or the way you understand free will to work? And so I'm very interested in exploring kind of the historical part of different shades of human beliefs.
And, there's such emotional resonance in all this for the reader. It's really a lovely combination of things.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Catherine Howe. It's a delight to meet you. It's a pleasure to have read your books.
Likewise.
And you can meet Catherine when she signs The House of Velvet and Glass at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street, Saturday, August 25th at 6 p.m. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
When I choose summer reading, I like to choose books in groups, sometimes set in places I love, sometimes set in places I don't know well at all. It's like planning a vacation. A few short stories, a long novel, a new writer, it's a way to get away. And this summer, I've had a spectacular time out west, in the past, present, and future. Here's what I've been reading. The Orchardist by Amanda Copland envelops us in the world of William Talmage, who grows apples and apricots in the Pacific Northwest. He's haunted by the mysterious disappearance of his sister. So when two young girls, Jane and Della, both pregnant, show up on his land seeking refuge from a very bad man, he's drawn out of his capacious solitude into caring for and about them. But love, as we all know, is risky, and loss is inevitable. Soon, one sister is lost, and Della disappears, bent on revenge against the man who victimized them, and Talmage is left to raise a young baby girl on his own. He is aided in this by the town's wise woman, Caroline Mitty, and the town judge, who see Talmage for the rare man he really is. But this caring, this love, will bring him out of the orchard into the world, and a cruel world it can be. This novel is rich in love for the natural life, deep in its understanding of solitude and the need for privacy. The Orchardist is also a vivid portrait of how difficult life in the West was, especially a life tied to nature. Breaking the ground, nurturing the trees, touching the bark for pests, climbing into the branches, picking the fruit, taking it to market. It's a hard life, but not one without consolation. All of these characters work hard all of their lives, and every moment is rendered in exquisite prose. Copland gives us the cycles of the seasons in all their sights and smells and sensations, but the seasons of the heart, growth and change, loss and tragedy, those are here too. And these characters are completely compelling in their loneliness, their determination, their hard-won wisdom. It's hard these days to say what might be a great American novel, but to my mind, The Orchardist certainly belongs among the ranks of the very best. Battleborn by Claire V. Watkins is a collection of 10 unforgettable stories set in the West of both the past and the present. It's one of those books where you think the biography of the author. Watkins is the daughter of Paul Watkins, who was Charles Manson's right-hand man and chief procurer, might overwhelm the work, but no. Enter her unforgettable world at your peril. She can conjure the mad obsession of brothers who go west for the gold rush, or the arid manipulations of a sex ranch with equal clarity, and even, in a story called Ghost Cowboys, her own complicated past. These are fierce stories, and yet there is such tenderness in this book. In the final story, Graceland, the narrator Katie ponders the problem of perspective in the world. All the great land mammals are dying. There were once birds the size of sheep. Pinnipeds used to be huge. Walruses had tusks 6 feet long. Jackrabbits had feet like 2x4s. Armadillos were as big as minivans. Now, they're all dying off. African elephants are going thirsty, having to dig wells in the dirt to find water. Bengal tigers are shot and skinned. Polar bears are drowning. Imagine the world's largest carnivorous land mammal drowning, an entire species drowned to extinction. You know what'll be the largest land carnivore after we've shot all the tigers and drowned all the polar bears? The grizzly bear. Which is to say, some mornings I wake up before the alarm goes off and just lie there and think how I'm not sure I want to live in a world where the largest carnivorous land mammal is the goddamn grizzly bear. And yet, as every reader knows, that's the world we're living in. The Dog Stars by Peter Heller is a vision of a future in which a wicked flu has wiped out most of the population. Hig is a pilot who now lives in an abandoned airport with his dog Jasper and shares his world with a sharpshooter named Bangley. He flies reconnaissance in his 1956 Cessna, thinking about the loss of his wife, looking for other people, hoping for good ones but worried about the bad ones. He hopes against hope to find solace with his dog, his unashamed co-pilot, and his fishing. One day, he hears a transmission that lures him away from safety in search of human voices, other people. He heads out beyond his point of no return, beyond the place where he has enough fuel to get back. It's an apocalyptic universe Hig lives in. "Did you ever read the Bible?" he asks. "I mean, sit down and read it like it was a book? Check out Lamentations. That's where we're at, pretty much. Pretty much lamenting. Pretty much pouring our hearts out like water." And that's what this book is, a lamentation, in lovely, poetic, idiosyncratic language. We see the glory and danger of flight, the difficulties of survival, the experience of grief, the fleeting nature of canine companionship, all the rich joys and troubles of being human. The Dog Stars is a book to get lost in, because it's a book that will bring you home. So that was my trip out west this summer. I've been changed by imagining the wide open spaces, I think, and certainly changed by every open book. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The wonderful illustrator Peter Brown signs Creepy Carrots, Wednesday, August 22nd at 4 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Marie Bookman signs her new collection, Breach of My Heart, August 23rd from 6:30 to 8 at Maple Street Bookshop. Cornell Landry signs The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo, Saturday, August 25th at 11:30 a.m. at Maple Street Bookshop. Angus Woodward signs Americanization, Lessons in American Language and Culture, Saturday, August 25th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Catherine Howe, reads from and signs The House of Velvet and Glass, Saturday, August 25th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop, Uptown. And if you're interested in joining a book club and you've got some daytime availability, the Lunch and Lit group will be meeting each month at the Keller Library Community Center Loft at noon on the fourth Tuesday, so it starts August 28th. The first book is Richard Ford's novel, Canada. Participants should bring their lunch. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.